In the coming week, U.S. combat troops are set to fully withdraw from Afghanistan. Ukrainian President Zelensky meets President Biden in the White House, and Iraq hosts a regional summit. It's August 26th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Carla Robbins.
Carla is an adjunct senior fellow at CFR, and frequent listeners of The World Next Week may recognize her voice from our summer reading special episode most recently. Carla, as always, great to have you on the show.
It's great to be back, and thanks, Bob, and an honor to be in the shadow of our friend Jim Lindsay.
Yes, thank you for subbing in for Jim. And Carla, we're going to pick up where Jim and I have been talking quite a bit about recently, which is Afghanistan. We are looking at the pending U.S. withdrawal. President Biden affirmed earlier this week at a meeting of G7 leaders that the U.S. would not be extending the August 31st deadline to withdraw U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan. As always with this podcast and Afghanistan, there are fluid events. There have been most recently reports as we're sitting down to tape this podcast about explosions near Kabul Airport. So, Carla, can you tell us what we should be looking for in the week ahead in this story?
So, as you said, you know, yesterday the U.S. and Australia and Britain warned that there was credible intel about a planned terrorist attack against the perimeter of the airport. And this morning, we're taping right now midday on Thursday, there are reports of two very bloody explosions. You know, it's impossible to say how many people have been hurt, but the Pentagon is suggesting that Americans were hurt. Does this mean they're going to speed it up? I mean, President Biden said the reason why he wants to get out and get out on his deadline is the chance that, you know, there would be something like this terrorist attack. Knowing the way that he has been handling this, I think this will make him even more committed to this deadline. That said, the numbers are not good. They still have a lot of people to get out, and whether this is going to increase or slow down the pace of the air bridge, the evacuations, is a very interesting question. This took place at the airport. So what we know right now is more than 82,000 people have been evacuated since the middle of August, including some 4,500 American citizens. Yesterday, the State Department said, you know, another 500 Americans were on their way out, but there were still about 1,000 Americans that they can't get in contact with, and they were frantically dialing, emailing, and trying to find them. So they don't want to leave those 1,000 behind if they want to leave. At the same time, they certainly, the pressure, and particularly if they've lost American soldiers, which President Biden keeps insisting is his primary concern. A few more data points. The Biden administration has reportedly identified around 50,000 Afghans they say are eligible for these special immigration visas, but an independent estimate that came out this week said that there could be 250,000 or more Afghans who could be eligible given their service to the United States and as well as their vulnerability. So, you know, when or whether these people will get out, including the American citizens, will the Taliban let the Afghans themselves get out, you know, once the Americans are gone, is a really big question. And then there's the politics of the United States. You know, overwhelmingly, Americans feel a huge amount of sympathy for Afghans who served with us. But you're beginning to hear, including from President Trump and some congressional Republicans on the Hill, the, not surprisingly, the anti-immigrant backlash once again coming. You know, Kevin McCarthy, who's the, you know, Republican leader in the House, said last week, we'll have terrorists coming across the border, he said in a private phone call that, of course, came out to the press. And President Trump has claimed that terrorists are already on the planes coming to the U.S. and that Afghans are taking seats that should rightly go to Americans. So the politics of this is going to get nastier if I had to predict. I think President Biden, predictions are very bad with Afghanistan. President Biden is going to probably stick to his schedule, but there, you know, he certainly doesn't want to leave Americans behind. And there's thousands, tens of thousands of Afghans that we owe a debt to who are definitely going to be left behind.
At this point, though, my understanding is that there are different phases of the departure of the Afghans. So let's get to the security question. The thousands of Afghans have already been airlifted out of the country, had, for the most part, my understanding is, Carly, gone through extreme vetting already and all sorts of clearances just to get to that point, especially those who've landed in the United States. There have been few who landed in Northern Virginia, for example, and there's been a lot of reporting in our area where I live in Northern Virginia about that. But then those who are in, say, Ramstein Air Base in Germany or in Doha and so forth still have other processes to go through. Is that right?
Yes, and this special immigration visa is a very complex process, and people have to come out with their documents. They have to prove their service. Their families have to be vetted. It's a very hard thing to do with a country like Afghanistan. And one can't disagree with this, you know, impulse here. I mean, we obviously have had extraordinary luck in avoiding a domestic terrorist attacks. And when you're talking about bringing in thousands of people, we have, you know, good reason to why we would want to make sure that we are safe within our own domestic borders. That said, when you start talking, we're not talking hundreds of people here. We're talking thousands and thousands of people we owe a debt to who certainly need to get out. And we are, you know, we can't house them all on military bases, and we're reliant on allies who right now are not feeling real friendly to us because A, we didn't consult them that we were going to be bugging out, and B, they've been housing a lot of refugees from a lot of other places for a very long time. So this politically is very challenging, logistically is very challenging, and from a security point of view is very challenging. Now, there was, interestingly enough, a recent CBS News YouGov poll that found that 76% of Republicans and 79% of independents still supported efforts to bring Afghans who have helped the U.S. here. So there's not an overwhelming anti-immigrant outcry so far, but God forbid something bad should happen.
And I think that also includes Mitch McConnell has been outspoken in saying we need to, you know, support our allies and bring them into this country.
Yeah, but when people start seeing that it's thousands and thousands and thousands, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens with President Trump. We know how, shall we say, intimidated some people on Capitol Hill can be when President Trump starts beating the anti-immigrant drum. And if, God forbid, something should happen from a terrorist point of view. So you've got a lot of pressure there and the security balance there is. So this vetting process, and, you know, there's a lot of criticism about the way that Biden has handled this. It was always going to be ugly. It was always going to be difficult. And we can debate whether it was the right decision. And certainly it hasn't been handled effectively on many different levels. But you can say, why didn't they start the process earlier? Certainly of reviewing the visas for these people, because that's a very difficult thing to do.
I think another passageway, if you will, we should be looking at as well, Carla, is the land borders of Afghanistan, to the extent to which Afghans flee, as they had in the past, and I'm talking 20, 30 years ago, to Iran in the west, or to Pakistan in the northeast, or Tajikistan in the north even, the extent to which that happens in any sort of higher numbers, or just the displacement within Afghanistan to places that are seen as less insecure. And then you have the need to work through the UN and maybe a few other major NGOs as the only kind of forces on the ground who can help people avoid a mass humanitarian tragedy.
You know, this is a choice, and this is, goes to this fundamental question about whether or not the Taliban, A, has control of Afghanistan. You know, we're acting as if they're in control. There's no sign they are. I mean, first of all, this attack was from ISIS. So they are going to have challenges as much as they're in our face. There are going to be people who are in their face, and not all good guys who are going to be in their face. That's the first thing.
And we should note, there's an ISIS affiliate that is...
ISIS-K.
ISIS-K, which has clashed with the Taliban. Is that right?
Yes. And I mean, that's what, that was the prediction, was it was going to be ISIS-K, and that's the belief that what these attacks were today. So how in control they are of the country, does this give more leverage to us and the rest of the world to get people out we want to get out after, you know, we're out of the airport? Does this give us more leverage to make them behave better toward women, so there's less pressure for people to have to get out? Does this mean at the minimum to get them to behave better so that they, you know, do they want aid? You know, last time around, they were perfectly willing to live cut off from the rest of the world and doing the terrible things they were doing, stoning women to death, blowing up the bombing on Buddhists, doing all the things that they did. They were completely proof from pressure. This time around, the betting has been that this is a somewhat different Taliban that wants to control Afghanistan and will be, you know, subject to some pressure because of the need for aid. I'm not persuaded, but, you know, let's hope that, you know, that this is a slightly different Taliban, because certainly there's going to be a lot of people who need a lot of help inside the country, you know, both from a humanitarian point of view and certainly for protection from their own alleged government.
The other dynamic that's possibly changing is the last time around, so the 20 plus years ago, the previous version, the Taliban was boxed in by countries including China and Russia. Recall in the Security Council, they were in step with the other members in all sorts of steps to really draw a noose in a way around Afghanistan, especially after, I think it was a combination of things, including the Bamiyan Buddhas and some, you know, human rights reports and opium trading and what have you, and then capped off by the 9/11 attacks. Russia and China are playing their cards closer to the vest these days. You know, a little bit, as we, Jim and I mentioned last week, a little bit of schadenfreude about what has befallen the U.S. effort in Afghanistan, but also sort of keeping their options open on how they might deal with the Taliban, which in the past posed a threat in terms of exporting extremism to their countries.
Certainly the great game is afoot. That said, they have a considerable amount to worry about. You know, they are very worried about terrorism on their own, you know, and certainly the Chinese are huge fear of any Muslim links within their own territory itself. And they're a hell of a lot closer to Afghanistan than we are. So, you know, they can, schadenfreude right now is with the diplomacy aspect of it. They are not going to want to see instability in Afghanistan. And believe me, instability is what we're going to be getting.
So we have a fixed date next week of a U.S. Military withdrawal, but
we believe,
but the situation will continue to play out in all sorts of other different venues.
Not going to be pretty.
We'll continue to keep vigil on this podcast, certainly.
So, Bob, let's turn our attention back to the U.S., where Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is going to be meeting with President Biden in the White House in the coming week. And the relationship between Washington and Kyiv is delicate at the moment as the U.S. nears a deal with Germany on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But there's much more than just the pipeline on the agenda for these talks. So what do we expect to come from this meeting at the White House? And, you know, and how much does Afghanistan play into this meeting, just as you were mentioning right before, the broader relationship, you know, feeling anxiety about this U.S. reliability? I was just seeing this morning that Putin's national security advisor, Nikolai Patrushev, was already spinning that tail because he told Fred Kemp, my old journal colleague, quote, that Ukrainians shouldn't rely on Americans because one day they would abandon it just as they did Afghanistan. The actual quote is, at a certain point of time, the White House may not even remember about its supporters in Kyiv. So how much is that going to be there on the table when they sit down?
It's a good point, Carla. It's going to be there as maybe a backdrop in terms of U.S. reliability, but not on the table per se. I think Ukraine still is extremely happy and interested in having this meeting in the White House, and the ability for Zelensky face-to-face with Biden to express Ukraine's deep, deep concerns about Russian pressure and Russian aggression in the region. There's all sorts of reasons for that. So first of all, on the Afghan front, we should note there will be a great deal of atmospherics around this visit that the administration is going to be dealing with the Afghanistan issue. It's the last day of the U.S. withdrawal as Zelensky comes to town. However, there's so many issues on the table between these two countries that are really important, and it's important for the U.S. to kind of reinforce its ties with Ukraine. I think you're going to see them getting down to business in a bunch of areas. So you mentioned Nord Stream 2. I think it's an opportunity to further exchange their differing views on that. The U.S. decided at the end of the day to not, should I say, counter Germany on its desire to finalize the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which circumvents Ukraine, which gives Russia more leverage on energy supplies to Europe, certainly, but also in its ability to just cut off the spigots of energy that flow through Ukraine and that Ukraine has been able to benefit from and taking payment from. There are already signs that those supplies are slackening as Nord Stream 2 gets close to coming online. So Nord Stream 2 will be a big issue. We should note the U.S. Energy Secretary attended a regional summit that Zelensky held last week on Crimea. They want to get Crimea back on the agenda. They want countries in Europe and the United States especially to continue to raise it as an issue, as an unsettled issue, even though it's, from the Russian perspective, it's finished business. They're moving on. It's not a discussion point. And it's probably true. And unless there's a sweeping change in Russian leadership, you're not going to see Russia coming back in any fashion on the Crimea issue. However, there's also the Eastern Ukraine issue where the Biden administration can express support and perhaps beef up some military support for Ukrainian side, which continues to deal with separatist forces in Eastern Ukraine. Overall, since 2014, that Russian-backed sort of separatism flared up, there's been 14,000 deaths. That's quite a high casualty toll. And there's been this sort of low wattage, occasionally spiked conflict going on. This past spring, there was a huge amount of concern when Russian military exercises and maneuvers near the border seemed to indicate some sort of action taking place. There's going to be Russian maneuvers taking place next month that have a number of Ukrainians concerned. And so there's a great deal of concern on their own territorial integrity. So you'll see Biden making affirmations about that. And then it's a question of, a lot of the Ukrainian pundits are saying, look, Ukraine has scored this meeting. It's really important. It should not press too hard on the NATO membership path demand. In the past, Ukraine has sought to be what they call a MAP, a membership action plan, sort of be part of this for NATO. This could be hugely problematic for all sorts of reasons, including amping up the antagonism towards Russia at a time when there's, you know, any number of crises the U.S. administration is going to be dealing with. But at the same token, I think you're going to hear a lot about the U.S. and Ukraine affirming support for reforms in Ukraine that make it, you know, strengthen its democracy, that strengthen its stance against corruption. Ukraine is famously one of the most corrupt countries, certainly in the Eurasian context. And so they're going to want to affirm that with Ukraine stepping up in this area, you know, the promise of further sort of drawing it into the Euro-Atlantic orbit down the road can continue to be, you know, presented there. So I think you're going to see some nuance in this meeting, Carla, and then some straight talking between the two sides, especially on Nord Stream.
If you recall the famed transcript between Trump and Zelensky, you know, there were deliverables, things were offered, you know, in exchange for getting dirt on Biden. You know, what does Zelensky want in terms of deliverables? I mean, they can get the statements on Crimea that they want, but we all know Crimea is not going back. Okay. You know,
right.
Certainly, when you talk about Eastern Ukraine, Trump did something that Obama didn't, gave them quote unquote lethal aid. I mean, do they want specific military aid from the Biden administration more than they got out of Trump? Do they want more? Certainly, they want more money because they're going to get, they're losing money because of Nord Stream thing too. So are there specific deliverables and is Biden ready to give it to them?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think on both those counts, I think you will see some, whether it's straight out comments about it or it emerges afterwards. I think on the energy front, I think there is going to be some promises along those lines for U.S. aid or help in kind that will help soften the blow of the Nord Stream coming online. And I also think on the military front, it's very possible that you will see new U.S. military assistance being offered in a way that will help bolster Ukraine's defenses while not seeming to be too, you know, potent offensively, if that makes sense, Carla. We should note that this month, Ukraine marked its 30th anniversary of independence. The country has, I think, especially in the last 7 years, assumed more of an identity of itself. It was still, I would say for many of those years, it was still very much sort of this hybrid country, very Russian oriented. Certainly there's a lot of ethnic Russians, especially in the East, certainly in Crimea, and Russian language spoken in certain areas over Ukrainian. You've seen much more of Ukrainian identity emerge, partly spurred by Russian antagonisms. And I think that's something that I think has surprised Russian officials. The Russians are very wary of Ukrainian asserting itself as any sort of an independent entity. There was an extraordinary essay that was published this summer by Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, where he basically said Ukraine's not really a country. It's part and parcel of Russia. This is silly to talk about itself as a country. And that's a feeling that a number of Russians have. And we should note that the Crimean annexation was popular in Russia at a time. And you're not seeing a great, you know, grassroots movement within Russia to end the annexation. So you're right. I think there's going to need to be some deliverables from the U.S. And we should also note that the neighborhood's getting sketchier and sketchier. Belarus has taken a severe turn for the worse in terms of, you know, everything from even further, you know, strengthening its crackdown on any opposition forces, on weaponizing migrants on its borders with, especially Lithuania, to some extent Poland. Those two countries have become safe harbors for opposition figures. And then you have even countries like Georgia, you know, which was this island of sort of democratic aspirations and sort of more oriented toward the EU and the US than any other country in the region. Georgia's turning more towards Russia's orbit recently. And so I think you'll see a desire to really kind of reinforce the U.S.-Ukrainian relationship, build that up, and recognize the importance of those ties.
So when I listen to your podcast next week, I'm wondering whether you're going to be talking about political fallout and whether the Republicans try to make some hay about the Zelensky-Biden photo op and some reminding everyone about the alleged Hunter Biden scandal, which we haven't heard much about. So the optics will be an interesting one.
What has seemed to get more attention, but that will be interesting to watch, Carla, has been the Nord Stream decision, the administration's decision, you know, not to sanction that pipeline, but to sort of let it move forward, such that you have senators like Ted Cruz has been holding up confirmations of important ambassadorial positions, and a number of other Republicans, some of them sort of more moderate in their stance in terms of domestic politics, have still been extremely angry about the Nord Stream decision. And so that could end up being the noise you hear more than you hear sort of the echoes of the two-year-old impeachment case involving Ukraine.
Unless, of course, Biden comes up with, you know, lovely deliverables on Zelensky. He sends Zelensky up to the Hill to chill Cruz out, which is, you know, Zelensky. We've seen other leaders do that. So we have a lot to watch for next week to see about how this plays and if it doesn't get completely overshadowed by Afghanistan. You know, Zelensky, who's been waiting for this visit, you know, may regret the fact that every question shouted at the press conference will all be about Afghanistan, and no one will remember after Ukraine used to be front and center of all American news. No one will remember even that Ukraine is there because it's all Afghanistan all the time. Not that I'm suggesting that reporters like you and me have limited attention spans.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, Carla, is Zelensky has proved himself to be pretty resourceful and resilient for someone who was a political novice and came in under incredibly difficult circumstances. He's got a huge burden to carry right now for his country and with his trip in terms of expectations. But he is an interesting individual to watch. So I'm going to be interested in seeing how he carries this off.
And he's not stopping at Mar-a-Lago on the way out, that much we know.
That has been confirmed. But Carla, I'd like to take us back to the greater Middle East, if you will, to Iraq, the other area where a U.S.-led war resulted in regime change and a country that's in a bit of a different place in Afghanistan at the moment. Its prime minister is Mustafa al-Kadhimi, and he's set to host what's called the Iraqi Neighboring Countries Conference in Baghdad. They've extended invitations to the leaders of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran. Those two are interesting. Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Kuwait, and the UAE. So far, we have not heard about invitations to Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. But Carla, can you tell us a bit about what this summit is and what its significance is?
So just think about this sort of counterposition of this. I mean, Afghanistan once was the good war. That's the war that everybody said made sense. And Iraq was what Obama called the dumb war. And now suddenly you have, Afghanistan, which is totally unraveling, and under this relatively new prime minister in Iraq, is trying to become a positive force in the region. Words I never thought I would say about Iraq. And even now, ones that I am having a hard time saying. Skepticism, of course, is always a very good idea when you talk about the region, and particularly about Iraq. So as you said, Iraq is hosting a regional security summit on Saturday. We're still unclear about the invitation list. And didn't Macron say that he was going to be coming too? They haven't also released an agenda, but, he's the former head of Iraq's intelligence services who came to power last year after anti-government and anti-Iranian protests. This isn't the first time since coming in that he's, taken on this role of peace broker. He tried to smooth relations between the Saudis and Iran and between Turkey and Egypt. But just keep in mind how incredibly unusual this is, not just because Iraq has been such a disaster since the U.S. invasion in 2003, because it was an incredibly disruptive force in the region. Think of the Iran-Iraq war itself. Think about the invasion of Kuwait, trying to turn Kuwait into, the 19th province, a war that I covered. It's been a long time major source of regional instability. And he apparently believes that he can't deal with his own internal problems, which are ethnic and economic, without trying to calm things down in what is a hugely difficult neighborhood. And the other thing that he gets out of this, even if he doesn't really get any deals, and everyone's pretty skeptical that he's going to really ever calm things down, is that he ups Iraq's, regional quotient to his, Q rating here, and it makes Iraq look more like a real player, which pushbacks against Iran's colonial designs on his government. Takes him a little bit more out of the shadow of Iran, which is good for him domestically, where the resentment of Iran is huge, and good for him internationally. Our colleague Stephen Cook from CFR, who's really my go-to guy on all things in the region, wrote recently in FP, that Kadhimi has a lot of reasons to try to be a peacemaker, but he questioned whether Baghdad has the tools to work with, what the influence, the resources, and prestige to forge a more stable region. He did point out that he has some assets there, these relationship and prestige going back to his time at Iraq's intelligence service. But he pointed out in particular, why would the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the Egyptians need Iraq's help at all? Listen, anytime you get these guys in a room together, it's better than not. But I think this more than anything else has to do with him and Iraq. But, I'm enough of an internationalist to pay attention and to hope, because no progress is better than nothing. And the region certainly needs a leader, because there was a time when the Egyptians were trying to play this role, and then when the Saudis were trying to play this role. And they're both, hugely disruptive forces themselves now, disruptive domestically within their own countries. They're no longer players. So let's hope.
Yeah, I take your point and Stephen's point about, what can Iraq bring to the table? But at the same time, I'm also really intrigued by this. I mean, it's been an interesting year for Iraq as well. They had what appears to have been a quite successful visit of the Pope earlier in the year. People forget it was the middle of another raging period of the pandemic, and the Pope still came, went across the country, went to every major region. It was an appeal to Iraq's old Christian heritage, but also to building bridges in the region. And the Iraqi security officials pulled it off as well. There were no major incidents that I had seen. There were no outbreaks of COVID that I've seen reported after the fact. Kadhimi is doing this balancing act, as you mentioned, with involving the Iranian influences. You now have a new, more hardline presidential administration in Iran, which is going to be interesting to see what they're able to pull off diplomatically as well. I do find it fascinating that he's able to convene. Again, we'll see who shows up and what kind of credence the other parties give all this. But it is, in the midst of everything else going on, it is interesting to see this juxtaposition of Iraq and Afghanistan right now.
And I suppose the other question I have here is that, President Biden has said also that, all U.S. combat forces are going to leave Iraq by the end of the year. Very different situation. Now, this is one of these, check out but never leave, because, he said our role in Iraq will be, to be available to continue to train, assist, and help and deal with ISIS that has arrived. So we're really not leaving Iraq. But Kadhimi needs him to say this too, because as much as there is a resentment of Iran, there's also been a lot of pressure to get the American combat mission to end. Interestingly enough, Obama pulled all the troops out of Iraq and then they had to go back, raising the question of what was Biden thinking in Afghanistan, but a conversation for another day.
Indeed, Carla. Another whole podcast.
Well, Bob, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 2,000 plus dead Haiti quake. It's pretty chilling, but that's what a Twitter poll sounds like. So Haiti, I mean, grim as ever. You know, it's, what, 11 days since the quake, more than 2,000 dead. There are places all over the country which don't yet have aid in there, and the world is not paying attention because of what's going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, Carla. It is interesting that our audience was intent on raising this as a lead figure for the Figure of the Week poll, because it is significant in and of itself. A massive quake, 7.2 on the Richter scale, followed by, you know, a heavy tropical storm, Tropical Storm Grace. And only a short while after the assassination of the president, President Jovenel Moïse, had already cast the country into a spiral of instability and all sorts of grave questions about governance that Haiti has been haunted by for recent decades now. And so it's really, how much more can this country take, and what is to be done? And so you have had, and it must be noted, you've had a strong response by relief agencies that are very good at this kind of thing in terms of the immediate response to an earthquake, to getting people shelter, to getting them food, to getting the basics provided, healthcare. The quake occurred not in Port-au-Prince like the 2010 quake did, which was far more devastating, but still flattened villages in I believe, the southern part of Haiti, and demolished places like churches and schools that have been among the few institutions kind of keeping things going, keeping societies together in that part of Haiti. So it's another massive need for help. At the same time, especially following the political assassination and other things going on, Haiti's been facing bigger problems with gangs, including gangs intercepting aid supplies. There's been a demand for more airlifted aid because roads are just being preyed upon by gangs. So it also raises the question, Carla, is there an appetite in the region for sending in some sort of a peacekeeping mission, heavy on the policing, that can help get normal people the goods they need to survive? Or is that, you know, cause its own problems?
You know, my first full-time overseas assignment as a foreign correspondent was the overthrow of Baby Doc. And I can't even count the number of times, you know, I've seen a tragic story in Haiti, and it doesn't ever seem to get better. And I remember when Aristide, you know, once, you know, the beloved priest who became the corrupt president, said to me, he said it to a lot of people, but I remember he did say it to me, it wouldn't take much help to take Haiti from total misery to poverty. You know, that his argument was it just wouldn't take that much to help make Haiti better, but somehow it never gets better. And when you think about the analogy to Afghanistan, it's, you know, it is a really interesting one. Is the lesson from Afghanistan that we can't fix places? I mean, there are a lot of people who are arguing that now. You look at a place like Haiti, which doesn't have a Taliban, and you say to yourself, all these years later, and whether you don't have to go back to 1915, all these years later, just back to the overthrow of Baby Doc, and was that 1986? I mean, why can't we get this right there? We were going to do it differently after the 2010 earthquake. Why can't we get this right? Why can't we take them from misery to basic poverty? This is in the Western Hemisphere. And everyone says that this time they're going to do it right. They said last time they're going to do it right. I think we have a transcendent moral responsibility. It's too close to the United States to not be able to at least get it right this time. But somehow we fail every time.
It's hard not to be that kind of dejected and frustrated, Carla. I will note something that in sort of the parallels with Haiti and Afghanistan that has also struck me through the years. It doesn't solve anything, but it's interesting to note in that you hear from people who've been correspondents and aid workers and NGOs and so forth, that in spite of what has happened in these two places, and I'll just say Haiti for now, there is an incredible sense of spirit in the people and resilience, that Haitians are incredibly dynamic, that there's some sort of quality of character that makes you want to root for them even more and succeed, and somehow can't get translated into setting themselves up in a proper way and having proper governance. And I've heard the same about Afghans as well, that through all the misery they've been through, they're incredibly warm and embracing outsiders and so forth. And so, you know, I just say that to say it's further reason to try to redouble efforts and help them. You know, one area that has been a help in the past has been the large Haitian diaspora in the United States. And I think probably see them kick into gear as well. There's a lot of very successful Haitians in the U.S. And Haitian refugees and people who've been allowed to settle in the U.S. have become the backbone of like U.S. healthcare and other sectors as well. But I do think you're going to see more networks built with them as the catalyst to try to bring some more aid down to Haiti. But I'm not sure. It's going to be multiple efforts over multiple years. And they were just in some ways starting to rebuild from 2010, just rebuild physically. But their political system, it seems shot to go along with just being laid waste by nature.
Yeah. I mean, one has to hope, and I do hope that we don't get so obsessed with our failure in Afghanistan that we don't, you know, that we retreat from taking our responsibilities elsewhere. And that's our look at the world next week. I wish it were a little bit more optimistic. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The G20 Compact with Africa Conference takes place in Berlin, and Ireland takes over the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council.
And I think the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament begins as well, Carla.
Oh.
So there's that, too.
There's something hopeful there, too.
Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts, guest hosts, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Carla Robbins saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.